and the new season begins. Hello from the Philosopher's Zone. Good to have your company again.
And as their thought matured, as they developed as philosophers, primarily working on logic and metaphysics, their mind turned to those issues when they were confronted with what they thought were catastrophic proposals for Australia's forests.
I certainly think they have an authority they don't deserve. Of course, not having a language that the ordinary person can understand is an important part of making sure that some people get to control it.
Val Plumwood, being wary of experts. She's known for being taken by a crocodile and surviving. Val was one half of a remarkable team. Her partner, Richard Routley, was known as the bad boy of deep ecology. Val and Richard brought clarity to an environmental debate that seemed forlorn. Richard died in 1996, Val in 2008. Philosopher Dominic Hyde wants their story to live on and their legacy to be properly appreciated.
I thought they were philosophers that exhibited the value that philosophy can contribute to a society in general. I thought they exhibited the virtues of clear thinking and rigorous analysis that can help us work our way through a range of problems. And they were interested in a particular set of issues, logical ones, which is close to my heart. I've long enjoyed it. But environmental issues too, that I think are of great importance to us. And I think they had really, really interesting views about that, and help lead the world, the academic world certainly, into thinking about those sorts of views in highly innovative, unorthodox and very rigorous ways.
They came to be known for their environmental philosophical thinking, but in fact their beginnings are in logic.
That's right, that's right. Richard started out in the 50s studying logic in New Zealand and moving to Australia in the early 60s, where he encountered Val, who was then an undergraduate student who was studying philosophy at the University of Sydney, who also moved on to work in logic. Logic was really their first love, but they quickly started to come across a range of other issues in the world around them as they matured that they saw as having great importance, in particular environmental issues. Richard had a background that obviously made him sensitive to it, and Val's mum very clearly sensitised her to environmental issues in the Sydney Sandstone Basin when she was growing up. And as their thought matured, as they developed as philosophers, primarily working on logic and metaphysics, their mind turned, quite crucially in the early 70s in Canberra, their mind turned to those issues when they were confronted with what they thought were catastrophic proposals for Australia's forests. And as very intelligent people, they turned their mind to what a lot of people would think would be a very grand task, analysing and evaluating Australian forest policy that was currently on the table, which was devastating. And they tore it to pieces economically, politically, socially and philosophically in a way that was quite devastating and to this day is said by a lot of senior people in that field as the most comprehensive analysis of Australian forestry ever done.
Let's just go back to the 60s and just talk about the personal story for a moment.
Yep.
They got together and they had a very interesting time through what is a very turbulent decade, really.
Yes, I mean, Val was enamoured early with philosophy because of the influence of John Anderson and that idea that philosophy could push social mores and push out into society more generally. She saw it as a vehicle for activism. As she graduated, well, while she was an undergraduate, she and Richard met each other. He was a lecturer fresh from Princeton, having abandoned his PhD in Princeton. Quote, they had nothing new to teach him, so he came back to Australia. But he brought back to Australia modern mathematical logical techniques. And in Australia at the time, there was a bit being taught at the University of New England, and there was a bit being taught in Adelaide. But the full power of these modern logical techniques had been resisted at Sydney by Anderson for what I think were quite interesting reasons. Anderson thought the modern theories that engendered a whole range of paradoxical problems went too far. Richard thought that it just didn't go far enough. So Anderson had withstood the development into modern mathematical systems and thinking about logic. He'd stuck with the Aristotelian stuff. Richard was moving on, was teaching it at Sydney at the time, and he and Val met and subsequently moved up to University of New England, UNE, where the New England Logic Group formed. So for those years in New England, we're talking 64, 65, 66, Val was a master's student. At the end of that period, at the end of 66, Val and her son John from a previous marriage and Richard got in a car and drove to St Andrews. When they arrived in St Andrews, Val at that time produced a paper on paradoxes in logic, some false laws of logic, and that was her first written paper, where she engaged with logical inference and the problems of the modern classical Russellian systems.
Mm. Now, here we are talking about classical logic and new forms of logic that they were putting forward, but how does that connect to the environmental philosophy that they then pioneered? Where does that fit?
Initially, there was no fit. Initially, these were very gifted intellectuals who saw something they saw as abhorrent, morally wrong, occurring around them, namely plans funded by the federal government to clear fell 5 million acres of Australia's hardwood forests as effectively useless bits of timber in order to put in softwood plantations. So they just reacted with horror. Having already developed sensitivities and loves for the Australian bush, Val's going right back to childhood. So they reacted initially simply to what they saw as something that was indefensible. And as philosophers, when you see what you take to be the indefensible, you look to see what the defences offered are. And the defences that were offered were paltry. They were quite absurd, economically absurd, socially blind, environmentally blind. It was really just a moral response to a problem. But as good philosophers, they started in this initial famous publication, Fight for the Forest, that was published through the ANU. It was primarily an economic and a social analysis. But underlying it all, they were starting to think that the philosophical issues here were confused and needed working on, and they did. And as they started to work through these issues to do with environmental justice, they started to see a range of other issues that started to percolate up more closely to logic. Issues about rational behaviour, self-interest, problems of cooperative action, the problems of current government structures, about the nature of democracy. They saw real problems across society in the way we manage the environment in particular, bolstered by some bad philosophical theories. At that point, when they started analysing those sorts of arguments about choice and behaviour, and social and political arrangements, they started seeing metaphysical and logical problems at the very heart of the way currently accepted dogma and orthodoxy in this area was set up as well, and started to tear that apart.
Well, I want to talk to you about what they considered were the right forms or the best forms of societal organisation to deal with it. But if I can take you back a step, the idea of human chauvinism comes into this, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Explain to me how they understood that.
Okay, I mean, we've been talking about logic and metaphysics so far, but the issue of value and the nature of value and meta-ethical theories of value quickly loomed as a big issue. Before they even published Fight for the Forests, Richard had written a paper in 1973, about 2 months after Arnie Ness had published his paper on deep ecology, a call for a change in our environmental relations or relations with the environment. Richard published a paper calling for a new ethic. The charge was that current ethical systems encapsulated some assumptions which had to be rejected. One was the sole value assumption that humans were the sole locus of value in the world, and to the extent that anything else had value, it was as a means to our end. So value ultimately resides with us. Other things are valuable insofar as they're useful to us. The greater value assumption might give ground on the sole value assumption, but nonetheless say, even if there are other things that are valuable in themselves, we are nonetheless always of greater value. So when push comes to shove, it's us and what matters to us that matters in the end. The view was, the call in that early paper was, we needed to rethink this, and that's what they subsequently did for the rest of their lives alongside all their other work.
This was at the core of a dispute between themselves and their old boss, was it John Passmore?
That's right. It was still chauvinistic, so what's wrong with that? Well, there's a very famous thought experiment that Richard put out there called the Last Man Experiment. And the idea was, look, if I was the last person in the world with a red universe destructor button in front of me, what would possibly be wrong with me destroying the universe a millisecond before my death? If there are no existing humans in the cosmos, there are no loci of value. If you're a chauvinist and you think all value is ultimately located in humans, there is no loci of value. It's not as if the destruction of forests and oceans could be deleterious to humans and therefore of disvalue to us, a negative means to our ends, as it were, because we no longer exist as an end that could be damaged or serviced better by the having or the not having of these things. Mm. It's an intuition pump that says, look, surely the intuition that there is something wrong with destroying all that stuff out there, even if it can't negatively impact on us, suggests that there is disvalue created. That disvalue can't be explained in terms of human interests and human value because there are no humans of value, because there are no humans. Passmore listed reasons why our civilization, our science, you know, all the things that people talk about, the wondrous creations of humans. And the response was, what about the wondrous creations of lyrebirds in song or intricate nests or complex activity by other animals? Why is the fascinating behaviour that they engage in and things that they make, why is that not as important or interesting or valuable as the stuff we create?
I can see his fear would have been also a slide back to a earlier, I guess, more spiritualized, pantheistic, pre-enlightenment phase of human development, if one were to go down that path.
Yeah.
There is some merit in that fear as well.
Well, this was exactly Passmore's charge. He said he worried about the return to a view of nature as sacred, inviolable and unalterable, and a return to a mystical pre-enlightenment past that we had worked hard to throw off. Now, I actually think the dilemma between a human chauvinist approach to environmental issues and that worry about an excessive mysticism, that is the essential dilemma that I think Richard and Val tried to work through their entire lives. And the end point Val came to in her philosophy with what she called a philosophical animism, it was a project to try and describe in a nuanced, subtle and sophisticated way how you could do what Richard and Val typically always did, sail straight through the horns of a dilemma. So Passmore sets up the dilemma. Either you accept modern post-enlightenment thinking that puts us at the centre with our glorious products, or you return to the Dark Ages, as Passmore himself said, a return to the Dark Ages. I think they successfully ran the values line and it worked well, but Val took the view that merely developing a philosophical view according to which value went well beyond the human was not enough to change the culture that we're in that behaves in the way it does to its own life-sustaining planet. The mere recognition that something else is valuable risks me being a voyeur staring at the other, saying, gee, isn't that valuable, and nothing much else changes. Mere recognition of value was not a sufficient impetus to action and cultural change. So she sought something much deeper than that. Moving on from the question of value in the 90s, she moved on to this question of, how is it that we can see non-human others, forest creatures, etc., how can we see them as agents in their own right, with their own projects, with their own interests that deserve to be respected? If you can start to, as I think many people who spend a lot of time in the bush naturally do, start to see the creature in front of you as something that has every much a right to exist as you do, maybe as valuable as you are in and of itself, you can see them as agents with interests. They have lives they're trying to pursue. They have preferences. They're trying to get stuff done in much the same way humans are trying to get stuff done. And I would find it abhorrent were I to treat another human as a mere means to my end. I mean, Kant reminds us of the abhorrence of this kind of attitude. Well, their view was, if you can really see non-human others, as they put it, as Val put it, having interests and preferences, having goals, seeking them, trying to live out lives, if you can see them in those rich, animated terms, you naturally come to see them as deserving of respect in the way that humans are.
Ecological Lives, Dominic Hyde, on the pioneering work of Richard Sylvan, born Richard Routley, and Val Plumwood, today on The Philosopher's Zone. Now, you would have thought this kind of way of thinking, this line of thinking, would lead to the sense that the best political or societal grouping would be probably around a collectivist, possibly socialist or Marxist approach. But in fact, interestingly enough, they both believed that a more libertarian line was the way to run a society.
That's right. That's right. I mean, one of the projects that they were engaged in from the early 70s was really trying to develop a strong theoretical foundation for alternative ways of living. I mean, in Australia in the 70s, there was a push for alternative lifestyles. I mean, there was this alternative cultures push. Most of the people pursuing it did it without strong philosophical foundations. And the philosophical foundations that were out there, Richard and Val, in typical idiosyncratic fashion, found to be severely wanting. So they set about trying to reconstitute secure foundations for alternative ways of living. And, of course, the political arrangements were central among them. And they thought that both the capitalist, individualistic approach to politics that we currently live under And the alternative, which was the big one at the time, of course, Marxism, were equally objectionable for similar reasons. There were large states remote from the coalface, unable to tune their responses to environmental problems as they emerged. They were both driven by a growth fetish. I mean, Marxism had a centralized economy, but it was still an economy that had to grow. So both of these worldviews were driven towards the growth of economies for the improvement of humans on the planet, to the large neglect of the cost that this would impose upon non-human others. And they came to the view that anarchism was really the only decent political foundation. But they were pluralists about their anarchism. Mm. So they're libertarian in a sense, but were very wary of neoliberal libertarian or neocon libertarian arguments coming out of America. And the more time went on, the more Val, for instance, became very wary after a tour of America in the late 20th century, the late 1990s, Richard was dead by this time. Val came back so horrified by the way in which anarchism was being used as a phrase in the US for a kind of libertarian view that, Nozick's book, Anarchy, State and Utopia, gives us a night watchman state. It's the idea that I have assets, I have wealth, and the duty of the state is to protect them from attack from others. And apart from that, the state really cannot justify its imposition on me in any stronger way than that. Minimal taxation to fund a police force or a military to protect me and my goods, and beyond that, nothing. The more general problem with neocon libertarian philosophies that Val particularly saw in the States when she was there was it was the protection of current privilege. Mm. So really it was about dismantling the state so that I can, with the wealth I currently have, not redistributed, but with the wealth I currently have, continue to thrive and flourish without the state imposing itself upon me. And this was just objectionable because it entrenched injustice from the start. But anarchism was the view they proposed, and a pluralistic kind of anarchism. That is to say, the abolition of a central coercive government. What forms of organisation ought people then engage in? Well, there's a huge variety, and that variety should be allowed to flourish. There are ways people can organise themselves, and there is no one template for this. The one thing, though, that we do all agree on, according to them, or ought at least, was the absence of a coercive state.
Well, their story is bigger than Ben-Hur. They went on, they separated, they went in their separate lives, they continued their work, they eventually both died, and have left quite a legacy. One thing I haven't mentioned, of course, and I should because it is integral to the philosophical discussion, particularly in Val Plumwood's End of Town, is that she was taken by a crocodile.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, I've heard people laugh about Val being taken by a crocodile in the sense, what a stupid woman who'd paddle a canoe around Kakadu. Now, people say that now, but at the time, in 1983, Val was given that canoe by a park ranger to go and look at a track they'd just constructed to provide feedback. It was standard fare for those rangers to be paddling those waters before the big increase in populations of crocs. Val finds herself paddling along and is attacked by a crocodile and death rolled three times and survives. She walks across country, collapses on a mud bank at dusk and is found by the rangers and rescued during flood period, got out of that place. The next morning, that area, which was surrounded by crocs when they pulled her out, that area was under a metre of water. She was dead. I mean, and she thought she was dying that night pretty clearly. They saved her. What she describes in a wonderful piece of nature writing and philosophy called Being Prey is the philosophical lessons that one can tease out. To it, you are nothing more than breakfast. Humans tend to think of crocodiles these days as breakfast. You know, we eat them. We think of chickens as breakfast. We think of lots of things as breakfast. We treat them as an object, Val would say. We, the master subject, who are invulnerable, treat these things as mere object. When she looked into the eye of that crocodile as it grabbed her around the groin and tried to kill her, she thought, that is an agent seeking to have me for breakfast. I am mere object to it. And with that shattering realisation of one's own subjectivity just fading away into the waters around you, she started to think, well, this idea of human invulnerability, we the master subject treating everything else as object, you realise in moments of predation when you, the human creature, are prey, that humans are vulnerable, that other creatures have agentive, for want of a better word, attitudes towards you. They are the subject treating you as mere object. That stark, visceral, to put it mildly, reversal of roles made her think, hang on, what is it that makes us think we are the invulnerable subject? Clearly we are not. It enabled her to start telling a story about how things look when you start to abandon the thought that we are always subject and it always object. If it is subject, then it deserves to be treated qua subject. And subjects don't get treated the way objects get treated. We treat cows in the feedlot as an object for eating. What if we treated it like a subject? That would be to start to consider its, you know, is it in pain? Is it suffering? Does it have ambitions to get to the water? I mean, you start thinking about it as something that has a life that it's trying to live. We typically think of it as walking meat. It's this reversal of roles that was so forcibly presented to her as this thing tried to eat her that she ruminates on in ways that are really very, very interesting, I think, to be very vulnerable. And it's the supposed invulnerability that she thought was at the heart of the problem. And that's closely associated with ideas of mastery, which are misguided. I mean, at one point she says, with the loss of predation on humans in the world, we have therewith lost something of the lesson it has to teach us about the resistance of nature and our own vulnerability. Now, she's right about that. What she doesn't mean is, let's go and put lots more humans in the way of carnivorous animals that want to eat us. It's just that historically we have been in situations where nature's presence and resistance has, in ways that are quite unpleasant, imposed itself upon us. But increasingly we can remove ourselves from any of that kind of awareness. And that's a danger too, because removing ourselves from that kind of awareness disconnects us from a world that is resistant, that does have a subjectivity all of its own, she argued, and that at bottom sustains us.
They weren't just big thinkers about big ideas. They also got their hands practically dirty and they contributed back to the common good, the work they had done.
They abhorred the separation of theory and praxis. The ideas that they wanted to instantiate in the world, they tried to instantiate in their own lives. So they thought that human consumption was excessive, that people had excessive needs and ambitions and desires for material goods. They had offensive ways of behaving in the world towards non-human others. So they sought out a quiet place in the forest where they could build their own house off-grid and live the kind of life that they thought was the appropriate one, the one that they were trying to describe in their philosophy. They built that house. It took them 5 years. They lived under conditions that a lot of people would find abhorrent. You know, they were writing groundbreaking non-classical logic papers by lantern light, kerosene light at night, after having spent a day working to build stone walls and cart stone around the place. They would often do work together whilst and with grad students whilst talking about material so that they could do philosophy while they were physically working. And Richard himself would always start work at dawn, finish at midday, and then he had a range of practical activities out there on the property. He had a number of properties which he bequeathed to conservation when he died. He had a number of activities that he wanted to pursue in the natural world. So life for them was to be lived and to be lived in accordance with the kinds of views they were talking about. So Plumwood was a 300-acre property that when they divorced, Val took over and she's bequeathed that to the nation. Richard had a 1,000-acre property south of Braidwood, magnificent wet sclerophyll forest, home to lots of rare plants and animals, that was bequeathed to Bush Heritage, a property, 500-acre property in New Zealand that he bequeathed to the New Zealanders, and a 150-acre property up on the Illawarra Escarpment. These were all very astute purchases of very high conservation value country, which was basically to be protected from the ravaging bastardry of developers as they saw it. And that's what they did. And when they were dead, they handed them back for people to manage.
The Philosophical Way of Val Plumwood and Richard Sylvan, born Richard Routley. From Logic to Forests, an extraordinary tale. Dominic Hyde is lecturer in philosophy at the University of Queensland. Details of his book on our site, where you can hear the program again, and while you're there, you can browse our extensive archive. Head for the RN front page and follow the signs. On behalf of the Philosopher's Zone team, Diane Dean and Joe Wallace, I'm Joe Gelonesi. Hope to see you next week.
The world's biggest democracy is voting now, but will religion divide the Indian people? The frontrunner says there's only one religion, India first, only one holy text, the Constitution. But when he condemns the slaughter of sacred cows, is it just anti-Muslim code? Meanwhile, the country's top imam says Muslims shouldn't back the Hindu nationalists. You can download or stream the Religion and Ethics Report at the RN website.